Good evening. This is Catherine Austin Fitz. It's Thursday, February 19th, 2009, and this is the Solari Report. I'm delighted you could join me this evening. This evening we're going to review the top stories in money and markets, and then all questions are going to be addressed with our movers and shakers guest, James Turk, the founder of Gold Money. I just want to give you a heads up, we may run over the hour, so if you can't stay with us, remember we'll be posting the MP3 file in the archive, and you can listen to it anytime. We should have it up, and within 24 hours, we'll have it up tomorrow. So money and markets. This week was a week of truly bad news. That's not bad news itself. The bubble covered up a lot of structural problems in the economy, where we have continually moved and shifted capital to things that were not productive. And so part of the process we're going through is a little bit like the infection rising to the surface, and the more we can see it, the more we can act. The stimulus package was passed by the president on Tuesday. One of the things that did is we've been watching a fundamental breakdown in the state and county cash flows that put real pressure on the intergovernmental relationships between the counties and the states, and the states and the federal government. And essentially what the stimulus package has done is provided an infusion in cash, which delays those problems. My guess is 6 to 8 months. It makes local government even more dependent on the feds. But the story's not over, because the federal government mandates significant programs and laws and regulations for state and local government, and as the tax revenues drop off to state and local government, they cannot deficit finance. They have got to balance their budget, and the federal government can keep deficit financing, and so the expense of complying with the Fed is going to get more and more painful, and being dependent on the feds is going to get more and more painful. So keep a watch on that story. We've talked before about the schedule in the spring and the summer with the March and April tax dates and the March disclosure dates. June 30 is the end of the fiscal year for many state and local governments. What that means is we're going to come through those tax dates, and if the state and local governments are going to balance their budget, they're going to have to be doing layoffs, and there's going to be tremendous pressure from them on the Congress, who's going to negotiate the new appropriations during the summer and come back for the September reconciliation. So watch that schedule this year. Now, overlaid into that, we're getting reports this week, two big stories up on the blog. One is an interview with a lawyer whose firm specializes in advising layoff corporations that are doing layoffs. And his prediction, based on who he's consulting with and the expectation of what they're going to lay off, is that unemployment is going to rise, could rise very significantly. Our reports is that, big story up on Yahoo tonight, that as of the end of February 7th, unemployment is now up to 5 million. So we have significant new unemployment claims. And that 5 million is just people filing and getting unemployment. Interestingly enough, Kauffman, which the Kauffman Foundation in Kansas City produces some great research on the economy and entrepreneurship. They have a great head of research, Bob Lytan, formerly of the of Brookings in Washington. The Kauffman Foundation just came out with a research wrap-up that you can get up on the blog. And one of the things it reported is that from 1980 to date, or to the end of the research period, 100% of the new employment in this country came from firms that had been in business for less than 5 years. So confirms, again, where we're seeing the unemployment generated from is from startup firms and new firms. And again, one of the big questions with the shakeout and the stimulus package is capital going to start flowing to those firms that are really generating the business and the employment. though the stimulus package has been in the news, the big news in terms of what's going on in Washington is the financial stability plan. The stimulus package is about $780 billion plus. The financial stability plan is projected to be, or estimated to be, $2.2 trillion. Now, let me put that in context. Bloomberg did an analysis last November and estimated that between the Fed and the Treasury, there had been authorization to provide loans or aid to the banks of $8.5 trillion. Now, the financial stability plan is on top of that. You add $2.2 trillion to $8.5 trillion, and you get $10.7 trillion. That number is bigger than the entire national debt when the shakeout started. Now, the financial stability plan is planning on bringing private capital in to basically manage, to buy, manage, and work out distressed assets. One of the reports this week, you'll see it up on the blog, is that the Carlyle Group in Washington is now amassing about $4 billion to bid on distressed assets. What that means is we're seeing the same patterns that we saw in 1988 and 89 with firms getting out, getting their cash out at the top, and then sitting on the sidelines and waiting and coming back in when it was really attractive to clean up the distressed assets. So it's we're in a situation, my guess is, that the Fed and the Treasury do not want government workers to see the fraud and the extent of the fraud in the assets, and so better to have private parties and insiders work them out. What that means is, though, that the buyers are going to control files that involve civil and criminal liability. So you're talking about a process which is going to be potentially very dirty, and it's not a good time to be in Washington. There was a chilling story in The Nation by William Greeter, who has been a Fed watcher and somebody who's written extensively on the economy. He points out this new documentary, IOUSA, which I've written about at the blog. It's a documentary that I've only seen the previews. I haven't seen the full documentary. The previews seem to essentially talk about the growth of debt in America as a result of an irresponsible population, and you get the feeling that the average American is to blame, and the solution to the problem is to basically turn to a group of wise people who understand the financial system. If you look at who those people are, in fact, they are the people who are responsible for many of the problems that are upon us. And sort of the theory is you should turn things over to them and they will fix it. Greeter points out his prediction is that this is going to be used as a justification for reengineering Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security, the theory being that we can't afford them, which is ridiculous. If we can afford to bail out the banks to the tune of $10.7 trillion, which is equivalent to our entire debt, and how can you not possibly afford Social Security? So the theory is we can afford to print money ad infinitum to cover up financial fraud, but we can't afford to print money to basically pay for Social Security. So keep an eye on that, because as many of you who know me know, I've spent many years basically saying, you know, where's the money? Where's the $10 trillion that disappeared during the 90s? Where's this $10.2 trillion going? Altogether, that's $20 trillion. So where's the money? And as the stimulus package wears off or wears thin, which it could do fairly quickly, that's going to be an important question, because the theory that we can't afford Social Security, but we can afford $10.2 trillion of bailouts is not going to hold water if everybody does the math. One of the things that has not gotten a lot of headlines, but that is very important, is we're seeing reports around the world of more and more drought. We have reports from China Australia, bad drought in California, and California struggling with very significant state and county deficits. At the same time, it's struggling with a drought. One of the things that happens when you read the financial news is that you rarely get a sense of what's happening with the land and with agriculture. One of my favorite quotes, and you'll find it up on the blog, says goes like this. It says, "Humankind, despite its artistic pretensions, its sophistication, and its many accomplishments, owes its existence to 6 inches, a 6-inch layer of topsoil, and the fact that it rains." And at some point, all or much of our wealth is a multiple of things that come out of the earth. And so if we have growing reports of drought and growing concern and reports of natural disasters like earthquake and tornadoes, those events are going to have a very profound impact on the economy and the ability to work out this sort of bubble of paper and debt. Another thing to watch for is, and you saw the tensions coming out of Davos and Putin's speech at Davos and the Chinese reaction to Davos, which you can read about up in the geopolitical section up on the blog. Watch for more force. If the U.S. dollar is going to remain the world's reserve currency and it's going to continue to subsidize this game, you're going to see a lot more force used to keep the dollar up. You're going to see a lot of countries eager to shift to other currencies. And that may, in fact, explain part of the strength behind gold and silver this week. One of the things I wanted to mention to you, because I think it's very important in terms of your time this year and what you can do to protect and preserve your time. There appears to me to be significant efforts, sort of disinformation efforts, in the media and on the internet to distract people from what's really going on. So rather than talk about where the $10.2 trillion is that's going to the banks, or the fact that we're about to authorize another $2.2 trillion and do it in a construct where the private firms can put their losses back to the taxpayers, so that's an open-ended put, and that $2.2 trillion may turn out to be a small number. Rather than discuss that, we have stories that inspire anger about some people getting benefits in the stimulus package or the mortgage packages making their neighbors angers who are not getting benefits. So there's kind of a win-lose thing. It reminds me a little bit of when I became Assistant Secretary of Housing at HUD. One of the things I noticed was that we, in our foreclosed properties, we were losing money because the buildings were so ugly and had no market value. And it turned out in many situations it would save money on designing them so that they were much more attractive. And I was assured by my staff that that was politically unacceptable if they got any government subsidy. It was essential to make them look ugly, even if it cost us more money. So, you're seeing a lot of stories that sort of pit one person against each other. I've gotten a bunch of emails on the internet that are designed to get everybody angry at people on welfare or people who get government subsidies, irresponsible people of modest mean who don't work hard. It's a little bit dovetailing with the spin you see in the previews for IOUSA. I've started to get people noting to me that their book clubs are reading books on racism and how they can heal from racism and, and different things sort of timed with Obama becoming president. And I just like to point out that I could feel a little bit like when I first moved down to Tennessee. I live in a county that's pretty segregated. And after being here about a year and hearing everybody complain about, why they had problem with the other group, so the whites had problems with the blacks and the blacks had problems with the whites, I started saying to everybody, I said, if you would just understand what was happening with the money and collaborate about the money, you could hate each other rich instead of hate each other poor. So the reality is when $10.2 trillion is disappearing now, or $10 trillion disappeared during the 90s, What we don't need to fall into is getting divided and conquered or getting distracted with sort of hate games. We need to really focus on what's happening to the money and what we can do that's positive. And that requires cooperation with other people, not sort of win-lose thinking. So it's really important to me this year that you stay very focused, not on what the centralizers are doing, but back to basics. Who's your farmer? Where does your food come from? I posted a seed story up called Seed Monopolists, and it's another chilling reminder of why it's really important to know where your food comes from. Where does your water come from? Again, you know, if you're in one of the droughts area, that's going to be an ever more important question. Who are your local municipal officials and state representatives, and how can you know them and support them? If we look at the tensions happening between state and local government, if you're in a state where that game unravels, it's one you want to watch. And then who's your banker? Anything you can do to make sure throughout the different parts of your life you're interacting with strong people, with ethical people, and focusing your time and attention on building the capacity you need to succeed in resilient and practical ways. You need to do it, and that requires other people. So we need to start finding ways of cooperating, whether it's in our community and our network. The Memphis paper says that the national CD rate is 1.51% and that the national credit card rate is 13.47%. I'm going to start watching this off and on when we talk. That means the opportunity, the difference between them, is 11.96%. I talked several weeks ago about a website, prosper.com, which had been put together to allow people to lend directly to each other, a little bit somewhat like Kiva.org is a not-for-profit. Prosper was a for-profit. And one of you notified me that that they've stopped new commitments. I went to look at their website, and sure enough, they're putting together an offering that's basically going to securitize their positions and allow the big financial lenders to finance them. And so we're back to something that could have been an alternative channel no longer working. And what that means is, whether it's in our families, whether it's in our communities, whether it's around a civic organization like a church or a club, we're going to have to find ways to drop that arbitrage, that 11.96% ourselves, and that's part of our opportunity. Okay, so that's it for money and markets. Again, there's a lot of bad news, and what's really important for all of us is to just focus on what we can do to kind of move away from the risk and start to really protect our position. And as all of you who know me know, one of the ways to do that is to make sure that our money is invested in a currency or is in a currency that's going up and not down. And that means that precious metals is a very important part of our sort of portfolio of strategies to protect ourselves in a time like this. And so it's my pleasure to introduce you tonight to our guest, James Turk, who's the very successful businessman, the founder of Gold Money, which you can find at goldmoney.com, and the author of The Collapse of the Dollar and How to Profit from It, which has now come out in paperback. It's one of the books I always recommend to people who want to understand the economy or understand precious metals. And he's coming, James is kind of a globetrotter, but he's coming to us from New Hampshire where he lives. James, are you with us?
Yes, I am.
Well, I can't tell you what a pleasure it is to have you on the Solari Report.
Thanks, Catherine. It's always a pleasure to speak with you.
Well, one of the things I know is that you're always trotting around the world and you always have amazing insights on the places that you've been. So I was hoping we could start out tonight and hear sort of where you've been, you know, sort of your latest travels and what you've learned about what's really going on in the economy.
You know, I've actually just been in the UK and talking there to a number of different people, as well as some people from continental Europe. And the economy in the United Kingdom is very, very bad. I think it's probably even worse than it is here in the United States. The toxic paper, you know, that's been sold around the world by American banks and other banks is really just coming home to roost. And I think the big takeaway that we should see from all of this is that the boom that we've gone through is a global boom, and the bust is also turning out to be a global bust. Interestingly, I was just in South Africa as well, and in a very perverse sort of way, they've been somewhat isolated by all of the problems elsewhere because of government-imposed exchange controls in the country. And so the banks down there weren't able to acquire a lot of the toxic paper that banks elsewhere in the world were buying, and they didn't have quite the boom that we've seen in a lot of other countries. But, you know, that's the exception. Based on what I've been seeing and hearing, this has been pretty much a global event, and there are a lot of places in the world much worse than the U.S. Eastern Europe is particularly dire at the moment.
Now, it's funny. I was in Estonia in November, and I flew through Amsterdam and Stockholm, and things seemed fine in Estonia, you know, in November. I was surprised at how, you know, just on the street and in the shops, it seemed just fine.
Yeah, Estonia is pretty free market oriented. I'm referring more to Poland, Hungary.
Right.
Ukraine is in dire straits, in part because of the natural gas problem they had with Russia, which has hurt some of their foreign exchange earnings and commitments. One of the problems is, you know, the weak currency and just collapse in industrial production.
Right. What do you have any reports from China and from Asia?
I haven't been there recently. I was there last year. But since I've been there, things have changed quite dramatically just within the last few months. Exports from China are down 30%. Imports into China are down 42%. This is year on year, which is, you know, indicating that the Chinese economy is also falling over a cliff. But it's not just China. It's elsewhere in Asia as well. Korea has been hurt badly in terms of drop in its exports, and Japan particularly has been hit, not only because of declining economic activity, but the strong yen has hurt its exports as well. While the dollar has
bounced, almost like global trade has just stopped.
Yeah, it's really just slowed down unbelievably. It's not anything that I've ever experienced in, you know, my 40-year career, and I'm not quite sure this is even anything that the world has ever experienced, because we've never been so globalized before. And to see something like this, you know, happen around the globe. But I was just looking at a chart recently of world industrial production and world trade, and it's literally just falling into the abyss. You know, obviously it's going to bottom at some point in time, but I don't think economic activity is ready to bottom yet. I think we're going to see more contraction because the excesses during the boom are still being worked off. I think we have a long way to go.
Right. I agree. I absolutely agree. Now, one of the things in the precious metals world we've been discussing for the last couple of months is whether gold is going to break out. And we've seen gold move up significantly in the last week or two. Maybe you could talk about what's been going on in the market recently and where we are and what your expectation is, you know, both in the short run and for this year.
Okay. First of all, when it comes to gold, I don't like to focus on the price so much because I really see gold as a form of savings. And as a consequence, what I recommend to people is you continue to accumulate gold now that it's undervalued and it still remains undervalued, because at some point in time in the future, you're going to need that gold and you'll be able to use it to invest or do things with. It's a form of savings, and it's you're saving sound money rather than depreciating national currency. So what I recommend is just, you know, consistently over periods of time, you know, accumulate it. You know, sometimes you might get a price that's a little bit higher, other times you might get a price that's a little bit lower, and don't focus on those prices, just focus on saving it. We're in a different market, different world since the collapse of Lehman Brothers back in September. And one thing that has become clear is everybody today is focused on counterparty risk. Counterparty risk means that you're asset is dependent on someone's financial statement, someone's balance sheet. And, you know, as recently as 6 months ago, counterparty risk was sort of an esoteric thing that few people spoke about. But right now, everybody's focused on, you know, how safe is their wealth. And when you look at wealth, it comes in two basic forms. It comes in tangible assets and it comes in financial assets. And what we're seeing particularly is a movement out of financial assets into tangible assets, and gold is benefiting from that simply because it's the only money that does not have counterparty risk, and it's very, very liquid. So where we are at the moment is at the gold's trading about $970 an ounce. It's down from its record high last March after the Bear Stearns collapse. It closed at a high at just over $1,000, at $1,003. And my view for this year has been that sometime during the first quarter, gold is going to go above $1,000, and it's probably going to stay in four digits, you know, over $1,000 for the rest of the year. And in fact, it may stay over $1,000 forever if the Federal Reserve ends up printing all of the dollars that are being spent by the federal government. And a three-digit gold price will become a distant memory, just like a two-digit gold price is a distant memory.
One of the things I always wonder about is the bond market is so huge, and the gold market is so tiny. And the minute we start to see people in the bond market, you know, and particularly retail, try and make a significant exit, the question is, of course, where are they going to go?
Right. Well, the bond market is huge, in part because of the, you know, credit expansion and all of the lending and borrowing during the boom years. But that's what creates the opportunity, and that's what makes gold so relatively undervalued.
Right.
But, you know, you're right about the bond vigilantes. You know, when they start selling, interest rates are going to go up, and they're going to go into other assets. You know, right now they've been, those other assets, I think, have been uncertain to a large extent as to where you move when you move out of bonds. You know, tangible assets, I think, are going to clearly benefit, particularly gold. We haven't really seen much in the bond market in the corporate side so far, although the spreads are widening compared to the treasury market, which people still perceive as a safe haven, although I don't agree with that. So you've had a lot of money come out of certain sectors of the bond market and go into the treasury market, but that in itself, in my mind, is a bit of a bubble at the moment.
Now, we've seen tremendous manipulation in the precious metals markets over the last, well, at this point, more than a decade, and I know it's something that you've written and spoken about. You recently had quite a discovery of a new document, and I'd love you to just talk about it a little bit.
Yeah, a lady discovered it in the archives of the Federal Reserve of St. Louis, and the author of the document is not known, but it was in the papers of William McChesney Martin, who was the Federal Reserve Chairman from, I think, 1952 to 1970. He was the longest-serving Federal Reserve Chairman. And the document dated April 1961. You know, the dollar was still on a gold standard back then. The U.S. was still in a very strong economic position. And the banks were not really leveraged very much. You know, when I went to Wall Street in the late 1960s, banks were leveraged at 6-1 rather than 40 or 50-1 as we've seen recently. But the document is very important because it basically lays out a blueprint for government manipulation in the various markets. It's, in my mind, perhaps one of the most important formative documents explaining how the government would have to intervene in order to enable the banks to expand credit beyond levels that were prudent.
One of the questions I have is, as we watch the extraordinary level of money being provided by the Fed and Treasury to the largest banks, is how much of this money is bailing out the positions that they've run up, manipulating the markets?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we don't really know how much of that is going into, for example, derivatives or into the paper side of the market. But, you know, the derivatives problem hasn't even really come to the fore. You know, we're talking about the bad loans and mortgages. At least there, you have a tangible asset supporting that that credit extension. But these derivatives are basically just make-believe pieces of paper, betting on certain events happening or not happening, and that has still yet to hit. But the derivatives have been very important in terms of market interventions and market manipulation. And interestingly, this Federal Reserve document going back to 1971 even touches upon derivatives, although they didn't use the term derivatives back then.
One of the most frightening days of my life, I was on the board of Sallie Mae in the mid-90s, and we had a presentation. They were building a huge derivative portfolio, and one of the guys in the finance office came in. He's a very smart guy, and he started to make a presentation, and I really didn't understand derivatives, so I started to ask questions, and we had vice chairmen from seven of the biggest banks in the country, and it turned out they didn't understand it either.
Yeah, I can believe that. I think that's why banks are in so much trouble.
I thought, who in the world is watching over this stuff? Anyway, so another thing I wanted to ask you about is the U.S. gold inventories.
Yes.
Does the U.S. still have any gold?
We don't really know for certain. You know, they claim that they do, but, you know, there's a lot of anecdotal evidence to suggest that a good part of that has been either swapped with other central banks or otherwise, you know, dishoarded. And the fact that they refuse to send in an independent third party, you know, a big auditing firm or something of that nature to confirm that the gold is held in the three depositories or the three vaults, you know, it just raises question marks about what's really, you know, happening.
What's really going on?
You know, to the gold reserve. Some of it may have been used to sell into the market as part of the manipulation. But, you know, here's the important point of the manipulation. We know why they're doing it. It makes the dollar look better by having a lower gold price. The gold price is the canary in the coal mine.
Right.
A rising gold price is signaling to everyone around the world that there's problems with the currency. So trying to cap the gold prices, making the dollar look better. But what they're doing is making the price of gold lower than it would be if they weren't intervening. So it creates a great opportunity for us
to buy.
Yeah, to buy and to accumulate. And, you know, just the steady accumulation of precious metals. Because at some point in time in the future, you're going to want to use those metals. You know, I'm a gold bug, but I see gold differently than most people. I see it as a two-way street. You know, there are times when you want to accumulate it and own a lot of it, and there are other times when you want to spend it. We're still in that first stage where you want to accumulate it, but there'll be a point in time in the future when you want to spend it. And I think there are a number of ways of determining, you know, how we determine that point in time. I like to compare a look at the price of the Dow Jones Industrial Average in terms of gold. And bear markets in stocks and bull markets in gold have ended when 1 ounce of gold bought the Dow. And back in the 1930s, at the bottom of the Depression, believe it or not, the Dow Jones Industrials was 34, and the price of gold was $35 an ounce.
Right.
In 1980, the Dow Jones Industrials was 800, and gold was 800. So again, 1 ounce of gold bought the Dow. At some point in time in the future, 1 ounce of gold is going to buy the Dow. Now, the interesting thing is we don't know whether it's going to be 1,000 on the Dow and 1,000 on gold, or 10,000 on Dow or 10,000 on gold, or maybe even 20,000 on the Dow and 20,000 on gold, because we don't know whether the Federal Reserve is going to inflate or deflate.
Right.
But we do know that in terms of purchasing power, again, 1 ounce of gold will buy the Dow. When it does, then you're going to want to use your gold and invest and you know, ride the next cycle, because gold will be at its maximum purchasing power, and your years of saving and accumulating gold will be rewarded to be able to buy a lot of things on the cheap.
Well, you'll hold your purchasing power.
Yes.
That's what you're going to do. You're going to hold, and that's been our experience. You hold your purchasing power, and if you price gold not in dollars but in a gallon of gasoline or any other measure of day-to-day staples, then you're holding your purchasing power, and that's the difference.
Exactly, and that's why gold has been money for thousands of years, and you know that's why the framers of the Constitution put gold and silver as the money of the United States in Article 1, Section 8 and 10 of the Constitution.
I think it was you or Franklin who told me that a man's good business suit in Rome in in ounces of gold cost the same as it does today?
Yeah, you could buy a man's business suit today for the same as a Roman senator could buy a toga back in ancient Rome. I mean, there are a lot of comparisons like that. You can buy a Colt 45 today for the same amount of gold that it cost you to buy a Colt 45 back in the Wild West in the 1860s and 70s and 80s. So,
wow.
There are a lot of different comparisons like that.
Art, let's just talk a little bit about geopolitics. To what extent is gold part of the geopolitical game we're watching between the U.S. and countries around the world?
You know, that's a really interesting question. You know, gold, let me put it this way, money is power, and gold is money. So whoever has the gold has the power. And one would think that the European central banks in particular, who have disordered so much gold in recent years, would think twice before selling that gold, because all of that gold is being accumulated by wealth-producing countries in Asia, India, and to a large extent in China. Gold, you know, is inevitably a part of geopolitics. It's been that way throughout recorded history. Wars have started over gold. Exploration has started as a consequence of gold. And the two are inextricably linked. You can't talk about geopolitics without talking about gold.
Now, one thing I called wrong last year was that I never expected the dollar to do as well as it did. And I think it caught us, a lot of us, by surprise. I'm curious if you think that the dollar can remain the reserve currency and what your prediction is for whether or not the U.S. can continue to finance this incredible deficit financing.
Yeah, the strength in the dollar caught me by surprise as well. But we know that the dollar bounced not because of fundamentally good reasons. It bounced because of the peculiarities of what was happening in the monetary system. You know, a lot of people had borrowed dollars, and they bought assets in Australia, assets in Eastern Europe, and elsewhere around the world. And with the collapse of Lehman Brothers and the deleveraging that followed, and this is true not only for businesses but also for hedge funds, they had to sell those assets that they had been acquiring in order to get the proceeds to repay the dollar debt. And what that did is it created an artificial demand for dollars to as a consequence of this deleveraging. Now, I thought that most of the deleveraging, particularly in the hedge funds, had finished by the end of December. But with the Madoff scandal occurring, that sort of threw a spanner in the works in the sense that I thought, okay, well, maybe that could cause the deleveraging to go even a little bit further. And I think we saw a little bit of that in the beginning of this year, back in January. But I think, you know, the deleveraging is largely over. The dollar may still go a little bit higher, but, you know, fundamentally the dollar is going to continue to lose purchasing power. Now, the interesting thing is, should we measure the dollar against the euro or British pound or other currencies? Not really. We should be measuring the dollar against gold.
Right.
Because gold is, you know, obviously holds its purchasing power. So the dollar may go lower, but it may be pulling all of the other currencies with it. And in fact,
when you look at the price of gold in all the currencies around the world, it's absolutely all the fiat currencies are falling.
Yeah, exactly. And while gold is still below its record high that we made last year against the U.S. dollar at 1,003, gold is at record highs against all of the major world currencies. And that's simply because the dollar has held on relatively strong compared to the other currencies of the world. But, you know, the trend is clear. Gold is rising in terms of all of the currencies, even against the yen, which has been even stronger than the dollar.
What's your expression that I love so much, inflation and deflation?
Yeah. You know, a lot of people ask about, you know, what's going to be the outcome? Is it going to be inflation or is it going to be deflation? And to me, it's quite simple. If you calculate the price of goods and services in terms of dollars, you're going to see inflation, rising prices. But if you calculate the prices of goods and services in terms of gold, you're going to see deflation, which is falling
right.
prices. If we were still on a gold standard as we were in the 1930s, you'd be seeing a tremendous deflation in this country. But what's happening is that overvalued assets, houses in California and things of that nature, are being marked down in price by a currency that's being ever debased and ever inflated. In fact, the government reported today the producer price index is up 4% over the past year. I happen to think it's probably higher than that, but
right.
You know, even by the government's own statistics, the dollar's continuing to be inflated away. But so don't be misled by decline in a lot of asset prices. The prices of these assets were bid up to astronomical and unrealistic levels because of the boom and the credit extensions during the boom years. But they became way overvalued, and now they're coming back to more normal values. But as their prices decline, but we're measuring those prices in terms of a currency, the U.S. dollar, that's continuing to be inflated away.
Now, when I met you, you were just in the process of starting Gold Money. You'd gotten your patents. And I would love, I want to ask you about Gold Money and what it does and how it works. But before we get into that, I would love for you to tell the history of how you came to basically invent and start Gold Money.
Well, it really goes back to what I learned from my parents about sound money. And when I was growing up in the 50s, I learned the stories of the Depression. And, when you want to buy something, you save up first and then you pay for it when you have the money saved up. I think I learned things differently than the way a lot of people learned. But, when I went to school, I studied international economics. I knew I wanted to get involved in international finance. Looked at how the world was working. And in the 1970s, I was working with Chase Manhattan Bank. I was living in Bangkok, Thailand. And a West German bank called Herstadt Bank collapsed. And it brought banking giants around the world to their knees. And I thought, this is absurd. How can this happen in, a sophisticated monetary system? I basically stepped back and, educated myself as to what the problems were. And in 1979, I had the idea for Gold Money, believe it or not. But it was long before the technology ever existed, and I did think it would happen in my lifetime. But the idea was so powerful that, I continued to think about it in the 1980s and refined the idea. And computer technology and communications moved much more rapidly than I thought possible, and started to study patent law, thinking, well, maybe I should carve out some intellectual property. And hired a patent attorney in 1992, filed the first patent application in 1993, put Gold Money together with myself and four other individuals in 1998, and launched, after doing all of the software development and getting everything together, in 2001. So we've been operating now for 8 years. We've got customers in over 100 different countries around the world, and at the end of January, we're storing for our customers gold and silver equal to about $550 million.
And they can all transact with each other in the same currency.
Yeah, exactly. you can also interact with the other currencies of the world. We've just added Swiss francs and Japanese yen, and we're now going to be adding some additional currencies later in the year, too. Hope to get the Australian dollar.
And you can do Canadian pounds,
euro.
Dollars. There's one other.
Euro.
Euro.
Yeah.
Euro. And you can deposit in silver and gold in
not
Switzerland
deposit.
Or UK.
Not deposit.
That's right. I'm not allowed to say deposit.
Yeah. No, deposit is a banking term. We're not
That's
a bank.
That's true.
And this is actually a very important point, because the term in gold money is called bailment. It's the same type of principle. If you're a farmer and deliver grain to an elevator, you expect to get that grain back when you're ready for it. The title doesn't transfer from you, the farmer, to the grain elevator operator. He's just doing a storage function. When you deposit money in a bank, you give the title of that money to the bank, and the bank can do with it whatever they want, including, lending 125% of a home value in California.
Right.
And you walk away from the bank with the evidence of debt. Of the bank owes that money to you. You walk away with a certificate of deposit, a savings account booklet, or a checking account statement. These are all evidence of debt, and that means you have counterparty risk. But with with gold money. We're not a bank. We're just simply storing gold that our customers own. They have title to it at all times, and we're just, you know, performing, as I say, bailment. They expect to have that gold returned to them, or silver returned to them, when they ask for it, and that's the whole principle behind gold money. In gold money, you do not have counterparty risk. You do have what I call performance risk, that we do what we advertise and what we disclose on our website. And in order to mitigate the performance risk, we have very strong governance procedures, but at the end of the day, we have the audit by the Big Four auditing firm that any customer can request from customer service. And it confirms that, you know, the weight of gold and silver in the vault is exactly equal to the quantity of gold and silver recorded in customer holdings, in addition to a variety of other checks and balances, making certain that our systems and operations are working as advertised.
Now, one question that we got, and I get a fair amount, is what I think of ETFs,
yeah,
exchange-traded funds,
right.
And maybe you could say a little bit about your feelings about the ETFs and physical versus paper gold.
Yeah, that's the key. You know, we talk about gold, but it comes in different forms. And the biggest break between these different forms is physical gold versus paper gold. You know, wealth, again, comes in financial assets and it comes in tangible assets. Financial assets is dependent upon someone's promise, and that's paper gold. Paper gold is a financial asset. Physical gold, you either buy it and store it yourself or buy it and have someone store it for you like we're doing in gold money. It's a tangible asset. Now, the ETF is a paper form of gold. You don't really own gold. You own equity in a fund, exchange-traded fund, that supposedly backed by gold. I say supposedly because they don't do what we do in gold money. We send the auditor into the vault, and he verifies that the weight of gold is there, and it equals the quantity of gold that customers own, gold and silver. The exchange-traded fund doesn't do that. You don't really have the absolute knowledge or the certainty that the gold is really there. Even the 10K that they report to the SEC, on the balance sheet, it doesn't say gold. It says investments in gold, which is clearly a paper product and not a physical product.
Right.
So I'm very skeptical of the ETFs, certificates of all sorts, you know, pool accounts and those types of things. They're better left to professional traders. When you're saving money, you want to save physical gold or physical
gold. Right. There are times when they're useful for hedging or some other minor things.
Yeah, but it's a trading vehicle.
It's a trading thing.
Yeah, what they give you, you don't, when you own paper gold or paper silver, you don't really own gold. You own exposure to the gold price, and that exposure to the gold price is only as good as the promise on the other side
right.
of the transaction.
Right. So it is. It's not owning gold or silver.
Correct.
Now, one of the things I love about gold money is I love liquidity, and if you buy gold and put it in the vault or bury it in your backyard, it's, you know, its liquidity is a little bit hamstrung, whereas gold money is liquid.
Yeah, exactly. You can, you know, sell at any time and have the money wired to your bank account anywhere in the world. So it gives you access, you know, to your gold and silver when you want it or when you need it. You know, coins are fine for a local area,
right.
local community. But it's limited that way. Whereas with gold money, you don't have those limitations.
Right, and you can have assets outside of the North America, which I think, you know, I love geographical diversification. So
yeah, exactly. You can store your gold and silver either in London or Zurich or both places, and it's important. You know, we know the history of gold confiscation in the United States. So to have some of your wealth stored in a different location, and you know, Switzerland's considered to be the safest of places,
right.
seems to make sense.
Right. We continue to get, even though we've addressed the issue of confiscation several times with Franklin, we continue to get questions about confiscation. And I thought you might just say a few words about what you think of confiscation possibilities.
Yeah. You know, my philosophy is very simple. You always hope for the best, but you always prepare for the worst. And in this country, gold was confiscated in 1933. It was made illegal to own until 1974. If it's happened once, it can happen twice. And so therefore, you have to be prepared that, you know, confiscation is a real possibility. You know, will it happen or not? You know, we don't know what the future will bring. But if you're prepared for the worst, then you can live through the worst if it should happen. So
right.
You have to consider confiscation as a real possibility.
Now, you were part, or you're certainly knowledgeable about, we've seen state legislatures, and I should point out I've got a post up on the blog called Feds versus States, and I provide links to some of the legislation that's been introduced. We have a spate of 10th Amendment legislation, but we also have, I think it's four or more states now introducing legislation requesting that the state administration set up payment systems, electronic payment systems in precious metals.
Yeah.
Can you tell us anything about what that's all about?
Yeah, it's really quite interesting what's been happening in this regard. It started here in New Hampshire. A few years ago, Edwin Vieira drafted a law, and a couple of state legislatures brought it to the Commerce Committee. I actually testified before the Commerce Committee, recommending that it be passed and, you know, put into law. Unfortunately, it's still tied up in the Commerce Committee because of the banking lobby and other people. I think wanted to see the light of day, but it will, I think, one of these days. But additionally, other states have move forward with similar legislation. I've been in touch recently with a state legislator in Indiana who's proposed a sound money bill there. Colorado has done one, and I may be testifying as an expert witness in Montana on a sound money legislation going there. Yeah, the intent.
Do you know who the sponsor in Montana is?
I can't recall off the top of my head. Sorry, but the idea is that it enables individuals to transact with the state in which they live in constitutional money, you know, gold or silver, rather than using Federal Reserve notes. It's completely voluntary, but it will enable that to happen. And the way the states will get gold and silver into its coffers is the sin taxes, you know, the tobacco taxes and things like that will be paid by the tobacco companies to the state in terms of constitutional money, and the state will then be able to use that constitutional money for anybody who requests transacting with the state in constitutional money.
That's fantastic. Any advice on what we could do to support making that more likely?
Yeah, I'm probably the wrong person to ask that because I really don't get involved in politics. I'm a money guy. I have to save that one for somebody who knows political system better than I do.
Now, since you're a money guy, we should ask you this question. One of the questions from our listeners is, what is gold
backwardation.
Backwardation, and what does it mean to us?
Yeah, normally the opposite of backwardation is called contango. And what it basically means is gold normally trades in contango. The spot month, you know, the price of gold today or gold's exchange rate to the dollar or the national currency today is lower than the price of gold at any point in time in the future. And this is called the cost of carry. What it basically is gold's interest rate. You know, it's the same logic as a dollar today is worth more than a dollar, you know, 12 months in the future. So by, you know, investing that dollar or putting it in a bank, you earn your interest. It's the same logic with regard to gold. Gold almost always trades in contango. It's very, very rare. And the reason is that financially the incentive would be because of the above ground stock. If it went into backwardation, you would sell your gold and people would actually pay you a very attractive rate to buy it back in the future. Mechanically, it works out that way, but essentially, gold's always in contango. However, during times of financial stress, it can go into backwardation. The spot price is higher than some future price. And interestingly, silver's been in backwardation now for 19 days in a row, and gold has actually been quoted on the COMEX. If you look at the COMEX closing prices for the different futures months for gold. The spot month is actually 10 cents above the, for February, is 10 cents above the March price.
Wow.
So it's even in backwardation on the COMEX spreads, which is very, very rare. The bottom line is this is extremely bullish, and it basically means that people would rather own precious metals than sell the precious metals, take advantage of the backwardation, and hold national currency. People would rather have metal than national currency, and that's very, very bullish.
How what can you tell about who's buying?
Who's buying gold?
Yeah.
You know, the gold market's very opaque.
Right.
It's really hard to distinguish. You know, there is a rule of thumb. Gold goes where the wealth is being created. So there had been a lot of wealth being created in Asia, and there's been a lot of gold flowing to Asia. Although recently, you know, the gold going to India has pretty much stopped. And a new type of buyer has come into the market recently, and it's pretty much the Western-oriented buyer who's been largely out of the market for a long period of time.
Looking for a safe haven.
Looking for a safe haven. I must admit, I've been sort of startled here so far this year by a number of phone calls, friends of mine who are hedge fund managers, talking about, you know, gold counterparty risk. I've even had a couple of discussions, guys who are trading futures contracts, talking about the counterparty risk of the COMEX, you know, clearinghouse, which, you know, previously had been unheard of. But, you know, it's quite clear that, you know, people are concerned about the safety of their assets. They're concerned about the dire state of the banking system.
Right.
And they're trying to get, you know, some of their wealth into something safe. And, you know, gold is a very easy, simple way to do that. And that's why you're seeing these weird things, you know, backwardation in silver and backwardation in gold. The demand for physical metal is so high. And I think the governments, you know, despite their best efforts to intervene and keep the gold price low, I don't think they can do it much longer, which is why I've been looking for a four-digit gold price this quarter, and then I expect, you know, gold to stay above 1,000 for the rest of the year.
Well, I was surprised. You know, I assumed that a new Secretary of Treasury would want to prove his stuff and make an effort to push it down. But there's been, it seems to me, there hasn't been a serious effort.
Well, maybe there has been a serious effort, the demand for gold is just so strong that it's finally reached the tipping point where government intervention can't keep the cap on the gold price anymore. I think the strategy in recent years has been to just allow the pressure to be released a little bit year by year in the hope that eventually it will dissipate. And, you know, gold has been up 8 years in a row in dollar terms with an average annual return of 16%. That's how badly the dollar has been depreciated
right.
over the past 8 years. But I think that even though, you know, gold has been going up, there's been so much debasement of the dollar that the pressure in the pressure cooker is building at such a great extent that I don't think they can allow gold to go up by such a relatively low rate of increase on a per annum basis. So I think you're going to see a ratcheting up of the gold price sometime this year. The physical demand has just been tremendous.
One of the things that really struck me when the president-elect announced his pick for Secretary of the Treasury is, in my experience, the Secretary of the Treasury is always someone with extraordinary principal risk. So, you know, they were Hank Paulson, and they ran Goldman Sachs, and they dealt with being responsible for very significant, you know, asset values that could go up and down. You know, there's nothing like line management responsibility for billions of dollars that can go up or down. So, you know, I had worked at Dillon Reed for Nick Brady, and he was another example. You usually had people who were extremely wealthy. You know, the mafia equivalent was made men. And now we have somebody who doesn't fit that description. He's much more of a, you know, a policy person without his own fortune and without having sort of made his bones in the money world.
Yeah, it's curious, isn't it? The other thing that's curious is that, you know, Obama was promising change and he brings in the same people who have been, you know, milling around the Treasury Department for years. You know, Geithner was right in the middle of it when all of the banks were exploding. So he, you know, really hasn't changed much as far as Treasury is concerned. I don't know really what to make of Geithner, to be quite honest. He is a bit of a bureaucrat, and he's been working behind the scenes for quite some time. I think he is a tool of banking interests, as most Treasury secretaries tend to be. And it's interesting that here we are several weeks into the administration, and they're still trying to formulate plans to deal with the crisis. I think, you know, we probably should take from that that they don't know what to do about the crisis.
Right. I mean, the idea that the Secretary of Treasury is meeting with the private equity holders to see what they will like.
Yeah.
So I'll never forget, I had a partner once said, you don't ask the market what it wants, you tell it what it wants.
Yeah,
exactly. one of the questions we got, which is an excellent question and one I think about, you know, I've thought about every day for years, and that is, are Treasury bonds safe?
In my mind, no, for two reasons. One is that, you know, a bond is a long-term play. So if the interest rates were to rise, the price of those bonds would go down in order to compensate for the higher interest rates on the coupon payments. And secondly, I'm still very bearish on the dollar. You know, despite the fact that the dollar's had a bit of a bounce against other currencies, it's been declining against the gold, which is, you know, the way I measure things. So I don't think Treasury bonds are safe. And to be quite honest, you know, I believe that we're on the cusp of hyperinflation, which will probably...
So if we're running a business or a household and we have cash reserves for the next 3 to 12 months, where do we put them?
Well, I think the metals, the precious metals, are still a safe place to go. I don't really recommend, you know, putting money in a bank. You know, why hold a T-bill when you don't earn anything in interest? It just doesn't make sense to me. Why hold a T-bond and earn, you know, 2.5% interest or whatever the number is at the moment? It's higher than that. It's about 3.5, I guess. When the inflation rate, you know, today was reported at 4.2 on the PPI. You know, at the end of the year, you've got less purchasing power, even taking into consideration the interest income, because the inflation rate is higher than the interest income you can earn. So that, to my mind, is not a safe strategy.
Here's the thing. Several years ago, my Solari Circle, it's a investment club, we changed our bylaws so that we could park our cash in essentially precious metals. And we were a group of people who had come to live with the volatility. So we were comfortable with the volatility, because I think one of the great strategies of keeping retail away from precious metals is the volatility. And even though the long-term trend is clearly much in your favor and you're holding your purchasing power, some people just, you know, they're not used to living with that. One of the advantages of living in the bubble is it's all very, you know, it's all very stable looking.
Right.
And, you know, you get a nice yield. It's sort of like investing with Madoff. Everything is nice and there's no uncertainty and everything's predictable until everything's gone.
Right.
One day. So, you know, living with precious metals is like living with the real world. And in dollar terms, it's up and down and up and down. So I think part of doing what you're suggesting is making that mental switch and learning how to manage in a volatile world.
Exactly. And don't focus so much on the price, because in the long run, it's going to work to your advantage. And in the short run and in the long run, there are other reasons for owning precious metals. You know, the fact that you don't have the counterparty risk is an important, you know, point.
Well, James, I just have to mention that I had my accountant miscalculated some taxes on our litigation settlement, and so we had to liquidate gold money at a low in the market. And it turned out they'd made a mistake, and I got the refund back, and it was $150 more to go back in. So it can, you know, when you're managing a business and short-term cash flows, it can be tough.
Yeah, it can be. I agree.
It can be tough. Now, we got a couple more questions I just wanted to ask you. One from, I think I know the answer, from someone who says, I own gold now. If I get a gold money account, can I move my gold into gold money?
We transact only in bars that meet the chain of integrity of the London Bullion Market Association. if you have one of those bars, you can put it into gold money. We do that for free. We put the gold equivalent, the fine gold equivalent, into your holding. The other alternative is you can go to someone like Kitco and say to Kitco that you want to sell these, you know, 10 Krugerrands or whatever gold you happen to have, but instead of sending you U.S. dollars, just put the gold grams into your holding at gold money. Kitco will do that. Franklin Sanders will do that as well.
Right. Now, another question we got, a great one. This is kind of gossipy. It's, why did Buffett sell his silver?
That's a good question. There's been a lot of speculation about it. You know, he said that he bought it too soon and sold it too soon. He bought it, averaged in around $4.35 and sold it around $8 or thereabouts. There was a rumor at the time when he sold it that you may recall that AIG and his company, General Re, they were involved in some potentially fraudulent activities. And the rumor was is that if he sold his silver, the feds wouldn't take the investigation up to his level. It would stop at a lower level. So anyway, his silver was sold and the investigation stopped at a lower level. Whether those are directly related or not.
A small price to pay to get out of litigation with the federal government, I can assure you.
Yeah.
Two more. What, in your opinion, James, what caused the Great Depression?
You know, without a doubt, it was the boom of the 1920s. You know, the credit extension, you know, the reckless lending, the reckless borrowing. What happened is that all of these dollars that were created by the lending by the banks and borrowing by, you know, companies and individuals, it created the illusions of prosperity.
Right.
But eventually, you can only carry so much debt on so much equity. You know, it's just a fact of life that debt has to be repaid and it has to be serviced. And the higher the debt becomes, the harder it becomes to service. Eventually, you reach a peak and people lose confidence in the system. They start withdrawing money from the banks. That creates the contraction and you have the bust. It's the boom-bust cycle of monetary history, and it's a result of fractional reserve banking, which is what we've practiced ever since the creation of the Bank of England in 1694. So just like you had a boom and bust in the 20s and 30s, we've gone through it again just recently. We had the big boom in the 80s and the 90s, particularly the 90s, and now we're going through the bust. And it's going to take a while to work its way through the system. And the government's probably going to make things worse by, you know, trying to encourage more debt instead of encouraging hard work and saving.
Right. We're not, you know, what we need is we need to let the market adjust. We need for things to adjust and get back to something productive. But many of the actions that are going to be taken are going to slow down that adjustment.
Exactly. And, you know, if you just look at it logically, the problems that we're suffering today are because there was too much debt.
Right.
You know, there's too much credit expansion.
So we don't need more debt.
We don't need, yeah. How can the solution be the same thing that caused the problem in the first place? It just doesn't make sense.
Right.
But, you know, the government is desperate to try to keep the economy from falling further. So they're bringing out this old formula that just doesn't work anymore.
Now, we heard this week Greenspan, from the wonderful people who brought you Pearl Harbor, we heard Greenspan suggest that we're going to have to take a partial nationalization of banks before this is over. Could you maybe just talk a little bit about what would that look like and what would it mean to us?
Yeah, well, this is happening already. You know, the TARP money that the government put into a variety of banks, and it's also happened in the U.K., it may keep the banks from failing, but the risk becomes the currency. You know, there's been so many new dollars created here, so many new pounds created in the UK to bail out the banks and to keep them afloat, that the real risk comes in the total destruction of the currency. And that's part of the reason why I think we're maybe 12 months away from a hyperinflation in this country.
I'm assuming, though, if they nationalize, that they wouldn't nationalize the whole system, they just nationalize the top five with the big derivative positions.
Yeah, and, you know, why haven't they nationalized already? It's probably the question. If their aim is to keep the banks from collapsing, It's because the private interests who own those big banks are very powerful people and have influence in Washington and don't want to be wiped out.
My fear is we have a lot of banks. You know, you have a lot of smaller banks and regional banks that are relatively healthy.
That's true.
And what you don't want to see is those basically used to subsidize the unhealthy.
Yeah, no, when you talk about nationalizing banks, and Greenspan talking about it, I think he's talking about the systemic risk banks, you know, the Citibank, J.P. Morgan Chase, Wells Fargo, and the big ones. I don't know if it's going to come to that, but you probably will see more mergers, you know, more potential WaMus out there and more potential Wachovias out there. They're going to be absorbed by, you know, the big New York banks, and somehow these big New York banks probably will not be nationalized. I don't expect that to happen.
Well, my favorite quote, I told you this earlier today, was when Chris Powell put out on the GATA wire, the Gold Antitrust Action wire, the article about Greenspan. His comment was, let's start with the Fed.
Yeah.
What do you think of the idea of nationalizing the Fed?
You know, I'm of two minds. What I'd really like to see in this country is competitive currencies, which is what Ron Paul has tried to encourage in Washington. In line with competitive currencies, I'd like to go back to some kind of constitutional basis. You know, the only powers that the federal government has is to coin money. It doesn't have the power to print dollars. That's not part of the Constitution.
Right.
It can coin money. That means you make coins out of gold and silver, which the Constitution specifically states. So it doesn't have the authority to grant a private cartel to bankers to create a Federal Reserve. So, you know, while I'm in favor of private enterprise, and it should be private enterprise running the monetary systems of the world, just like private enterprise is doing a better job at anything else in the world, it should not be a cartel-like private system, which is what the Federal Reserve is and what the Congress has granted unconstitutionally. So I'd like to see two things: competitive currencies and going back to a sound monetary basis as the framers created in the Constitution, and also the Coinage Act of 1792. You know, back then, there were a lot of private mints competing with the federal mint. It wasn't an exclusive right given to the federal government.
Right. No, I bank at a community bank out in Pennsylvania.
Mm-hmm.
And if you walk into that, it's a tiny office, but they're run by my Quaker relatives for many, many, you know, more than a century. And you go back and you can see up in their walls the currencies that they used to issue.
Yes.
And so, you know, that was a community currency.
Yeah.
You know, so there were competing currencies.
Yeah, there were, until the National Bank Act of 1860. And then that's when you had the greenbacks, and Lincoln used the paper currency to finance the war between the states.
Sitting on my shelf is Edwin Vieira's book, Pieces of Eight, which you got me to buy. And I recommended it in a Salieri report earlier, I think it was this year, last year. And I got a note from a subscriber saying, I just went to Amazon and to buy a used copy of some ridiculous, I mean, it's a huge amount of money.
Yeah, it is. It's a few hundred dollars, which is basically prohibitive. but I did speak with Edwin about it recently, and I gather that he's planning to release it in a new CD.
Oh, fantastic.
Yes, I think that would be really good. So I've been waiting to get some word from Edwin that it's going to be available in a CD.
Well, it's funny. You really don't understand our history until you understand the history of our money.
That's exactly right.
And one more question before we close, James, and you've been very generous. One of the questions I always get on the notion of going back to a gold standard is, well, there's not enough gold and silver to make four liquid currencies.
Yeah,
maybe
you
could just touch on that.
Yeah, if there wasn't enough gold, the consistency of purchasing power that we were talking about earlier, you know, wouldn't apply. You know, an ounce of gold buys a suit just like it bought a Roman toga for a Roman senator. What happens is that the above ground stock of gold grows by 1.75% per annum pretty consistently year after year after year. So you have this continually expanding above ground stock of gold, and that's approximately equal to world population growth, and that's approximately equal to new wealth creation in the world. So you have this consistency over long periods of time between demand, people, and supply, gold, and new wealth creation by which it's being measured. That's why gold is money. It's the only thing we produce for accumulation, or I like to call it saving. Everything else is, you know, produced for consumption and disappears, but gold doesn't
right.
disappear. And what you have to do is you have to look at the above-ground stock of gold compared to the above-ground stock of dollars, because that's really determines the exchange rate between those two, and the demand between those two really determines, you know, gold's price or gold's exchange rate, however you want to describe it.
Well, the other thing, to me, if you have a sound money system using gold and silver, and people are free to have competitive currency, so municipalities or states could do something or a community could do something, and they're, you know, there is a lot of wonderful stuff that could be happening that's really consistently stopped and dirty trick by the cartels.
Yes, exactly.
And so you stop that dirty tricking, and there's nothing to stop barter systems from blossoming and all sorts of other things, but they'll do it in and around a fundamentally sound backbone of just what you described.
Yeah. In fact, I was just reading an article Telegraph, one of the London papers. I think it said there were 65 local currencies now in Germany.
Isn't that amazing? Yeah. Ambrose had an article about it on the blog.
Exactly.
Yeah. I listened to a presentation of one of the people running one of those late last year, and it's quite extraordinary what's happening.
Yeah, it really is. It's showing that, you know, people have had enough of the moneyed interests, and they want to have something, you know, closer to their own locality. And I think competing currencies make sense. And in my mind, using gold and silver as a local community currency is probably
well.
The
for
best
you know, if we can get enough of us just not thinking in the dollar, but thinking in ounces, then you know, so then this is, you know, we're working up our way to be the sixth monkey. The 100 monkey. Okay, well, James, thank you so much. You've been very generous with your time. I can't thank you enough. You have a column, I think, every week, is it, in goldmoney.com?
Yeah, pretty much every week or two.
Okay.
You know, I write about the current state of the gold market and add a little bit of perspective as to how I see things evolving.
Okay, well, we're linked. We linked to you from the blog, so... I really recommend to all the listeners, James' column on the markets of gold money is always worth taking a look at. Okay, well, James, have a wonderful evening. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Catherine. It's been a pleasure.
Okay, well, ladies and gentlemen, we look forward to being with you on Thursday, March 5th with John Rubino. John was the co-author with James on his book, and has authored a new book, which is absolutely fantastic. I recommend it to you strongly. It's called Clean Money, Picking Winners in the Green Tech Boom. I'm looking ahead. This is not something that you're necessarily going to need during the shakeout, but the shakeout's not going to last forever. And enterprises that figure out how to do more with less natural resources are going to be very important to our world, and so I think John's book is beautifully written and really takes you through a complex subject in a way that is very, very understandable. The movie we're going to be doing on March 5th is called The Endurance. It's one of my favorite documentaries. It's an extraordinary story of Shackleton's expedition to Antarctica, and it's an extraordinary story of leadership. And leadership skills are something we're all going to need in this environment. So I really want to talk about that. So John Rubino, Clean Money, Picking Winners in the Green Tech Boom, and The Endurance is the documentary. So just remember, you're in our prayers. Please remember, don't worry about whether or not there is a conspiracy. If you're not in a conspiracy, then you need to start one. Good night and good luck.